Stephen Price for the appellant, Melanie Fine, trustee. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, as this is a 40-minute case. May it please the court, I have the privilege of representing Melanie Fine. You will recall that this case was before this court 2.5 years ago, and at that time, in its decision, it reversed the circuit court in Fauquier County and remanded it for the purpose of conducting a hearing to determine whether or not the subdivisions, which are the subject of this case, were violative of three specific provisions of the applicable restrictive covenants that incorporated the 1997 Fauquier County Subdivision Ordinance into it. The covenants are valid. These covenants are clear. These covenants are definite, certain, complete, and reasonable, and should be enforced. The facts in this case are a little muddled by virtue of the efforts, the successful efforts, I might say, of the appellee, the subdividers, to muddy the water with respect to these covenants. With respect to the ones dealing with the road issue, in their applications to the county for subdivision approval, and we have to step back and remember that there are two sets of standards that the subdivider had to meet. The first were the subdivision ordinance that the county had in 2007 and the applicable zoning ordinance. And then there was the second set of standards whereby the covenants incorporated the restrictive covenants. And what happened is that the subdivider, the appellee, Ms. Payenda, and her, it was subsequent that her LLCs were substituted for her, that Ms. Payenda's counsel argued that there were other provisions in the zoning ordinance which relieved her from having to comply with the zoning ordinance, with the subdivision ordinance that had been incorporated into the covenants. And then also, this is completely at odds with the position that the subdivider took with respect to the county, where they had asked for waivers of the road design standards, saying that we couldn't meet them and therefore we'd like to have them waived. So we have some inconsistent arguments there. I'd like to try to clear things up. I'd like to take the court, if I might, quickly through these covenants and indicate where the evidence established that they had not been met. The violation basically is that these subdivision plats were recorded without the requirements of the covenants having been met. And I will point out that the section in the covenants was by virtue of an amendment that Mrs. Payende had insisted upon before she bought the lot. So we're not talking about her being surprised. These were a provision that she had requested as a condition of buying the lots, and so this is what she violated. I direct your attention to the subdivision ordinance of 1997. That's section 2-39. That would appear on page 839 of the appendix. And under this section, subsection 3, it contains what's called the large lot exception. That is, where you're subdividing into lots of 50 acres or more, the procedures and conditions and terms are a little less restrictive than an ordinary subdivision. And in fact, it says that, this is on 2-39-3, that there can be approval by the county's subdivision agent. It's permitted for the following. And then under C, this is the specific large lot exception, the division of a lot, tract, or parcel of land into two or more parcels, all of which are 50 acres or greater, for the purpose of transfer of ownership or building development, provided. And I highlight the word provided. And then under 3, under this subsection C, it says the design standards of Article 7-303.1 of the zoning ordinance are met. And we turn over, this is the only section in the zoning ordinance that's referred to specifically by the subdivision ordinance. So if we turn over to Article 7-303.1, that's at page 865 of the appendix, you will see that, that this concerns the design standards for private streets. And subsection 1 says, types 1 and 2, such facilities shall be designed to meet minimum applicable requirements as contained in Appendix C of the code, comma, the subdivision ordinance, period. And then you'll see that there is a section dash 303.2 thereafter that says type 3 none. And this was the first mistake that the circuit court made, because when it issued its first letter of opinion, it read this subsection 2 as being part of it, but that is not referred to by the subdivision ordinance. It's only 7-303.1. And so this says that that the facilities, that is the private streets, are to be designed to meet minimum applicable standards as contained in the subdivision ordinance. So you go back, it's a mirror that takes you back to the subdivision ordinance. And in a way, this whole process is a little bit like a UCC issue where you have to work your way through Article 2 or whatever it is of the Uniform Commercial Code. But anyway, you go back to the subdivision ordinance. And if you look at the 1997 subdivision ordinance, page 848 in your appendix, you will see that this is the Section 5, Streets, General Standards of Design. And then I'd further, within that Section 5, I would further direct the court to Section 5-6 and Section 5-8. 5-6 says that maximum street grades permitted shall not exceed 10%. And 5-8, cul-de-sac streets, says that cul-de-sacs should not exceed 700 feet in length.
May I interrupt you with a question?
Yes.
You caught my ear when you mentioned the UCC flowchart.
Right.
That's exactly what I did when I tried to figure this case out. But there's a fork in the road that I don't quite understand, and that is, unlike a typical UCC flowchart or bankruptcy law flowchart, where every chart item is a legal proposition, the first fork in the road here goes from restrictive covenants to law for its ordinances. The restrictive covenants is a contractual concept, of course, a property interest contractual concept, and of course the ordinance is law. Does that mean we should or should not put the thumb on the scale on the interpretation of the incorporation clause, given that restrictive covenants are narrowly construed so that free alienability of property is the default?
Well, I think the restrictive interpretation rule only deals with questions of ambiguity, and therefore they're construed narrowly. But you don't use that rule, if you will, define an ambiguity in a restrictive covenant. And I think these are absolutely clear. It directs this, it lays out these are what the requirements are to have a large lot waiver. And then with respect to this design requirement, directs you to 7-303.1, which says that they shall be designed to meet minimum applicable requirements as contained in the subdivision ordinance. So one looks at the subdivision ordinance and you look, where are the road design standards? And there's an entire section, Section 5, that's entitled Streets, General Standards of Design. But I would point out that on two different times, Ms. Payende asked the county for waivers from these requirements with regard to her legal subdivision application. The first was she had to seek a waiver from a zoning requirement that said that streets in the subdivision have to connect directly to a public street.
But you know, of course, the party's interpretation and the actions that follow it, you know, obviously don't create law or cause any interpretive deference on our part.
No. No, not necessarily, but I think it's clear, but I think it's important that's the interpretation that they have. And they, so in connection with that zoning waiver, she also asked, that is Ms. Bienda, also asked the Board of Supervisors for a waiver from these road design requirements. And it's very curious, if you look at the minutes of that particular meeting, the Board of Supervisors totally ignored, overlooked, didn't even respond to the request for the waiver from the road design standards. So then, in connection with the subdivision, and there was three separate applications for technical reasons, so three, we're talking about three re-subdivisions, she asked staff for a waiver from these roads and all from these road design standards, and all because she said that they couldn't be met. And so, in fact, the evidence would show that they were not met. I'm sorry.
If we agree that the subdivision agent cannot waive the standards, and if we agree, walking through the flowchart, that it should have been a type 1 or a type 2 road, that there wasn't an option to have a type 3 road, the primary relief that you seek is to have the subdivision voided.
That's correct.
Our Schilling case makes that problematic. What other relief is available? Or why would Schilling not apply to prevent us from voiding the subdivision in these circumstances?
Well, I can speak well to Schilling because I was on the losing side of that case in this court. That has to do with it's a standing case whereby it says that, in fact, a neighbor who's directly impacted by a subdivision next door has no standing to challenge the approval of a subdivision by the county. We're not here challenging the approval of the subdivision by the county. What we're saying is that that's all well and good that the county approved it, but you have two sets of hurdles to get over. The first is the county's, and we're not questioning that. We're talking about the covenants, which in a very curious and perhaps unique way incorporate the requirements of the subdivision ordinance. So here it's just a matter of contract, and we believe that the standards of equitable relief are appropriate to vacate the subdivision in this case. You all examined this recently last year in the Norfolk Southern Railway Company versus Breeden, and the majority in that case held that really as a matter of course, without discretion, that in a covenant case, if there's a negative covenant that's violated, that the aggrieved party is entitled to to injunctive relief as a matter of course. Now, in that case, the dissent said, well, there should have been more, in the facts of that case, there should have been more of a hearing with respect to whether or not that was going to create a hardship, injustice, it was impossible or unusually difficult for the court to review.
Okay, so counsel, sure. Presuming that injunctive relief is available.
That's correct.
Under Schilling, we would then have two options. We could have a mandatory injunction to require type 1 or type 2 roads. Or your argument is that we are capable of voiding the subdivision because the subdivision ordinance was incorporated in the restrictive covenant.
That's correct.
Are either of those acceptable remedies?
Well, no, Your Honor, and what's looming behind this? This is not just an academic exercise where someone in the subdivision wants to watch their neighbor jump through these hoops and cross their T's and dot their I's. As a result of these subdivision or re-subdivisions being put to record, Mrs. Piende then proceeded to use her heightened voting power to amend the covenants. In a fashion that were very unfavorable to my client. We itemized the ways that these were, we would say, arbitrary and capricious. And, for instance, abolishing the Architectural Review Committee, vacating some easements that my client had benefited.
Should we address that in this appeal? Or
sorry?
Should we address those concerns in this appeal?
Well, that wasn't part of the relief we asked for. And, in fact, there's another case involving all the lot owners that was filed after during the pendency of this case. But in this very case, when that amendment was threatened while we were challenged, straight away Ms. Fine filed a motion for a temporary injunction to ask the court to enjoin Ms. Piende from going ahead with efforts to amend the covenants to this whole issue of subdivision had been resolved, and we could see Is she in fact entitled to five additional votes for these five additional lots? And the circuit court declined to grant a temporary injunction. So it's more than an academic exercise. And in fact, if you look at the covenants themselves, they're focused not on whether there should be, the specific section is, not on whether there should be an approved entrance to the highway, whether there should be an HOA. It's focused on the act of subdivision. And it says that, and the general rule in the subdivision is that you can't re-subdivide lots. They made an exception for some of the larger lots, but it says that you can only re-subdivide these lots subject to the requirements of the 1997 subdivision ordinance. So Mrs. Piende did re-subdivide her lots, but she didn't follow the requirements. She didn't conform with the requirements of the 1997 ordinance. So if you haven't done what you're supposed to do in order to re-subdivide, and then you it's like ill-gotten gains from that wrongful act, amend the covenants in a fashion that are very injurious to my client, then the appropriate remedy is to vacate the subdivision. And we have
I'm not exactly sure, Council, why it's still not an academic exercise. We vacate the subdivision because they have to have type 1 or 2 roads. Goes back. They put in type 1 or 2 roads. She resubdivides. She has her 5 votes. We're right back where we are. Why isn't it an academic?
Well, because I will point out to you that it's impossible for her to design roads that would comply with Article 5, of the covenants. It says that you cannot have more than a 10% grade. If you look at the plats, I can direct your attention, and plat we also have in there that has the topographic details. It's clear that these lots have roads that are greatly in excess of 10%. Second of all, she could not comply with the instruction that lots should not exceed, the roads or cul-de-sacs should not exceed 700 feet in length. If you look at some of these cul-de-sacs that were put in here, some of them border on 10,000 feet long, not 750 feet or even 800, 10,000 feet long. She could not comply with it. She said she couldn't comply with it when she was in dialogue with the county, got a waiver, a staff waiver, and so that's how, with respect to the county subdivision, she was able to get an approval.
So if we were to find that staff doesn't have the authority to grant a waiver, and we were to find that it has to be a type 1 or type 2 road under the subdivision ordinance, and we were to remand it with directions to the court to enter an injunction requiring type 1 or type 2 roads, where would that leave you? Where would that leave her?
Well, Your Honor, I think the appropriate remedy is to vacate it and say that it has to start all over again.
If Schilling permits us to.
But I think...
You've made a good argument why you don't believe Schilling does.
Well, I'll give you... another reason, in the case of Leek versus Cassati, 234 Virginia 646, that's a 1988 case, that concerned partition suits, and where parties had applied for judicial partition of land, and this was private parties, no government was involved, and one of the parties objected, saying, well, you're not entitled to partition because what you're asking to have done is not consistent with the subdivision ordinance, and that kind of trumps it. And the court said no. I'd like to quote exactly from what the court said. It said that the legislature will not be deemed by implication to deprive the courts of their traditional equity powers to administer justice between private parties. And that's what we're here today about, and that's to ask this court to administer justice between private parties with respect to a contract.
That principle is a broad principle.
It is.
The discretion of a chancellor on either the issuance of injunctive relief or the scope of it. But that's a little different from saying that there's only certain kinds of injunctive relief that really can be issued in a particular kind of case.
Well, I'm not saying that there's any limits in this case. I was trying to respond to Justice Mims saying that the standing principle in the Schilling versus Jimenez would prevent this court from exercising its judicial powers, its equitable powers, in fashioning the remedy. And this is not a case where we are challenging the county-approved subdivision. We're just saying that what they did not comply with the contract between the parties, the covenants, which happened to incorporate the covenants. And so the appropriate remedy is for them to go back and ask to be directed to that it's null and void ab initio, and ask the court, the county to vacate the subdivision, which is an administrative act by the county.
I've got a question for you. You, as you stated, certainly we can administer justice as a, between the parties. So when we issue this injunction, it would have to be against the parties, not the county.
That's correct.
So if we say that the subdivision is a void ab initio, how can we say that when the county has created the subdivisions and they're not parties to the case?
Well, of course, I'm out of time. May I respond?
Okay.
The specific release we're asking is that the court declare the void ab initio and direct the property, the lot owners, to undertake those steps to have the plat vacated administratively. An owner of land that holds multiple lots that have been subdivided, there's a ministerial provision where you pay a $150 fee and ask the county to vacate the lots. Now, part of the defense to...
Can I stop you for a second?
Sorry.
Because, and maybe you can help me with this. How can we say it's void ab initio when it obviously isn't? I mean, the county has created these subdivisions, and it seems like they're avoidable, but they weren't void when they were created because they were done pursuant to the ordinance.
Well,
it's the covenant that makes them improper.
That's
it's not
correct.
What the county did. That the county followed the law.
Well,
as they understand,
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. But we don't have standing to raise that under the Schilling case.
Right. So if what the county did was legal, although in error because of the agreement between the parties, what do we do?
Well, I think still it's to declare that they're void, that they were not properly enacted when they were recorded, not enacted, they weren't properly affected in accordance with the covenants, the agreement between the parties, and that they should be vacated. And I think it's important that the date that finally that they were invalid, the date they were recording, is important because of the vote that took place to amend the covenants in that injurious fashion. That had tremendous negative impact on my client.
Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Michael Caudwin. I'm here on behalf of the Appellees, Zan 70 LLC and Dima Van LLC.
Before you get into your argument, Mr. Price has carefully given us the flowchart, UCC or whatever, the flowchart that makes the case that a Type 3 road is not permissible in with a large lot subdivision, is not permissible in this particular subdivision because of the restrictive covenant. What is your flowchart that counteracts his? That would show us why his might not be correct. I'd like for you to walk us through the two ordinances and explain why a Type 3 road is okay here.
Sure. The only explicit reference to the zoning ordinance comes in the large lot subdivision provision, which is C3.
On page 841.
Correct.
Okay.
It says, the design standards of Article 7-303.1 of the zoning ordinance are met, except that, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, okay.
If you then turn to that section of the zoning ordinance,
page 865.
Correct. You see that it describes type 1 and 2 roads and then refers you back to the subdivision ordinance. So there's a suggestion that type 1 and 2 roads have some sort of design standards. Then it says in subpart 2, type 3, none. There would be no reason to refer the subdivision agent, someone administering the ordinance, to design standards when there are none. So I would suggest that that's one way to interpret it. In addition, let's remember this is a restrictive covenants case. And why should the rule be different here than if we're just subdividing the land as between us and the county?
Okay, bear with me a moment.
Sure.
Before you get to that argument, let's go back to page 841. The design standards of Article 7-303.1 are met. It never references 303.2.
it would be easy to have written the design standards of 303.1 are met, comma, unless type 3 roads are appropriate, are determined to be appropriate by the subdivision agent, comma, and then go on. But that's not how it's written. We don't have a mandate to look at point 2.
And our argument is only if we're submitting approval for type 1 and 2 roads do we then have to comply with the design requirements for type 1 and 2 roads. If we're proposing a type 3 road, we don't have to comply with any design requirements.
Well, if that's in fact the case, why wouldn't they in C3 just say the design standards of Article 7-303? Why did they put the point 1 there?
That's a good question. And I think that the Fauquier County Subdivision Ordinance and Zoning Ordinance is not the perfect example of excellent draftsmanship. But what the zoning ordinance does in another section is it expressly permits type 3 roads in large lot subdivisions. And so,
and
where I was wondering,
what page of the joint appendix will we find
that? That would be 864 and 865.
Okay, where? Help me out a little bit. Double
section 7-301.
Right at the bottom.
Okay.
1.
Gotcha.
Type 1, 2, and 3 private streets are permitted in RA, RC, and residential zone for administrative subdivisions approved in accordance with ..., and divisions under 2-39 of the subdivision ordinance, i.e. ..., large lot division.
Can I stop you here? Because it almost seems like to me that hurts you instead of helping you.
Yeah.
Because knowing that, if they had just left the point 1 out, you could have type 3 roads in these large lot subdivisions, and it's pretty clear how everything would work. You go to 303, if it's a type 3 road, it's clearly allowed by the zoning ordinance, and there's no requirement. But instead, they kind of straitjacket you into this, you know, 7-303.1, which seems to be some indicia that they mean that the roads have got to be type 1 or type 2.
And also, go ahead and answer that one. Sorry.
It's possible, but look at what happened here. The Fauquier County Subdivision Agent determined that we can have type 3 roads. If we could, as between us and the county, have type 3 roads, which we explicitly can, because the zoning ordinance permits it, and ordinances have to be read together. Why? Because we're in a restrictive covenant setting. Should it be any different when restrictive covenants are supposed to be allowing the free use of land and supposed to be strictly construed? In addition, you do have some
part.
Can I
interrupt you there and make sure we frame that and make sure I understand it, at least? If there were no restrictive covenant and we're just dealing with the 97 subdivision ordinance and the zoning ordinance, which of the three types would have been allowed, forgetting restrictive covenants?
Any.
Okay.
And if it's a type 3 road, you have no design standards.
So we had to broadly interpret the restrictive covenant in order to get a restriction in the permissibility of 1, 2, or 3?
Yes, I think you'd have to have the most narrow construction of the restrictive covenants and the subdivision ordinance itself to say we can't have type 3 roads. In addition, it's not entirely clear what the heck a type 1 or 2 road is. It's not defined in the zoning ordinance. It's not defined in the subdivision ordinance. There's a reference back to the subdivision ordinance for what the design standards might be. Our argument, though, and this is what Judge Parker articulated as well, that the other sections of the subdivision ordinance don't apply because we're a large lot subdivision. And a large lot subdivision is, under the ordinance, not a subdivision. It's therefore exempt from the provisions of the subdivision ordinance. All you have to do is meet what's set out in subpart C, subparts 1 through 6. And so there's no explicit restriction, in my view, as to what type of roads that we are able to have in this particular subdivision. And the subdivision agent stated that you can have type 3 roads. That's in the record.
Can I draw your attention to something which, to me, I find a little bit bothersome? Go to page 103 of the joint appendix. You know, as someone said, at one point there was a request made to the Board of Supervisors for the waiver, which eventually the staff gave concerning the type one or two roads. And in support of that agenda request, it looks like the Planning Commission wrote an amended statement of justification concerning allowing the waiver concerning type one and two roads. And on page 101, look at the second paragraph from the bottom, where they say, in order to minimize the physical and visual impact of development on the property, the applicant also proposes to use type three private roads rather than type one or type two roads that would otherwise be required. That's what the county's saying about it.
But then you have a statement from the county's subdivision agent who administered the 2007 ordinance, which is identical in all material respects to the 1997 ordinance, that says type three roads aren't frack permitted.
Well, but they are permitted if you get a waiver. And I'm not to throw you completely off the game, but let's go to 104 and this same document from the Planning Commission. And you go about halfway down the page. It's like you go down, there's like an ellipsis, then there's one line, then there's another ellipsis, then there's a three in parens. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
And then right after that, they say Section 7-303.1 effectively mandates Type 1 and Type 2 private streets in connection with the subdivision of the property. That's what they said in trying to get a waiver, trying to grant the waiver that your clients are asking.
That actually, it's our statement of justification, point of clarification. So that's what my office said as they were preparing that statement of justification. I'm obviously
Are you
litigation.
Approbating and reprobating?
I don't believe so. And again, as a land use applicant dealing with Fauquier County, and I've had to do land use cases there, these ordinances are difficult to interpret. And I think that, you know, there was a thought that maybe a waiver was necessary. There was a waiver applied to the Board of Supervisors. There were two waivers, the private to public street connection requirement, which was expressly granted, and then the resolution that adopted that waiver, and that waiver is expressly permitted. And this is in the joint stipulation, Exhibit 16. It's not in your appendix. They also reference that, you know, we're allowed to construct the streets as shown on the waiver plat, which showed where they were going to be going, and also had a profile for the road. We have other arguments as it relates to this road design issue, and those arguments are again, it's a mystery to me exactly what your type 1 and 2 roads are supposed to look like. We did submit a profile on our waiver plat, which was a part of our subdivision application, that showed what a cross-section of this road would look like. That was taken right out of the subdivision ordinance itself. In addition, there was no evidence presented by them as to how our roads weren't type 1 and 2 roads or how they violate the subdivision ordinance. There wasn't an expert that stood on the stand and said, here's how you interpret, Your Honor, this topography map, here's what they're proposing to do, and here's a clear violation. No one testified that there was a violation of X provision of the subdivision ordinance, and that clearly applies here. And so they didn't meet their burden on this issue at all. In addition, remember, this is just a subdivision plat. You plat out your lots. Here we showed generally where the roads are going to go. But then there's extra steps that need to be taken. If a grade issue becomes something that has to be enforced, you can engineer just about anything. And yes, the topography is tough out there, and it'd be better for everybody if we didn't have to, you know, plow through the countryside.
Right.
But it's not as if that's something that couldn't be taken care of at a later date, and you submit erosion and sediment control plans, and you go get a lot grading permit, and you actually show more detailed construction.
But you're saying it would be, never mind. I think I understand what you're saying.
Counsel, let's go to, you wanted to move on from the road design. Let's go to assignment of error 7, which I really didn't see much that dealt with that in your response brief. And assignment of error 7 says that it was not proper to waive any provision by the subdivision agent. That we disfavor waiver when it comes to subdivisions. That's our Greengale case.
Right.
Lay your finger in the joint appendix on the authority of the subdivision agent to waive requirements. I found the authority to approve or deny.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't find any waiver authority.
In terms of the subdivision agent as it relates to the road design, there is no express authority. It's our position that if there's a Type 3 road that's being proposed, no waiver is needed because there's no design standards, there's no construction standards. Did we apply for one? Yes. And the best I can do to reconstruct it is that the administrative process for the county at the time was, if you want to do a Type 3 road, you have to show us that, you have to tell us that, and we're going to approve it, and that's what happened here. But if no waiver is required, and you agree with my argument that a Type 3 road is permitted, then that's essentially just a red herring, and it's not really applicable. The county didn't do anything
wrong. It would be a different question if it was the Board of Supervisors approving a waiver, or even perhaps it was the Planning Commission approving a waiver. When I see a local government employee making a binding decision, I'm generally going to look for where is the chain of authority? What document? Where is the Constitution locally or the statute locally that allows this person to have that cloak of authority? I haven't found it here.
I would submit that it's found in the zoning ordinance, which allows for Type 3 roads which have no design standards and no construction standards, in that if you don't have to design to anything, then really a waiver isn't necessary. But if they choose to grant one, so what? It doesn't really usurp the ordinance, because the ordinance already allows a Type 3 road which has no standards at all. In addition, the board, again, in the resolution that I directed you to, did describe, that the preferred means of access be by a private street that connects to Apple Manor Road, shown on the revised waiver plat. The board did have in front of it what we were proposing with respect to where the roads were going to be and how we were going to design the road.
If we agree that you have to have type 1 or 2 roads, what are our options?
I think one option would be abatement, which is what the trial court did with respect to the Homeowners Association issue, which is a perfectly reasonable remedy. It's actually contemplated in the subdivision ordinance
itself.
Well,
actually, you have a Homeowners Association right now, so you don't have type 1 or 2 roads right now, is my understanding.
So what I'm saying is that there was one issue that the trial court found that we hadn't complied with, and that was the requirement to have a homeowners association
right.
to maintain the private streets. When the court made that finding, we went out and created one, even though, as we have in one of our cross assignments, we articulated that we thought our road maintenance agreement complied with the requirement. The point is, that's abatement, and that's a permissible remedy. It's a form of injunctive relief.
When you say abatement, you mean it's just enforcing the terms of the restrictive covenant.
Correct. It's not all or nothing here. You have to vacate the subdivision, and that's the only remedy. There are other remedies, and in this court's restrictive covenants jurisprudence, it's made people take down things.
Would an appellate court make that call in any event? I mean, even if we disagreed with you on the type 1, 2, 3 issue, would it be us or the trial court who determines the actual scope of the injunctive relief?
I think that you could remand and say, we find that they violated this, remand it to the trial court for determining what the appropriate relief is. Alternatively, you could issue an order as well. And
it's a discretionary call. The scope of injunctive relief is inherently discretionary, and yet we're not sitting as trial judges here.
True. Yeah.
May I ask you one question, circling back to one of the first arguments that Mr. Price raised? Do I understand this point correctly? If 7-301 does not factor into your flow chart, you do lose the road issue. In other words, if we were to disagree that 7-301 and the scope that's allowed for 1, 2, and 3 type roads is not covered within the incorporation by reference term of 2-39(3)(c)(3), you lose.
I don't think so, because I think you have to look at the evidence before the trial court and the testimony.
Okay, putting aside the whether it is or isn't, or this type of road or that type of road, just whether which type is available for this kind of subdivision.
I think the court would have to figure out, which is a lot asking the court to do, and it was their burden, how we violated the subdivision ordinance, if those are the types that we had to design to. There was no testimony from an expert that said, here's the road requirement, I'm an engineer, here's what they needed to do, they didn't do it. And in addition, you'd have to, first of all, figure out what a type 1 and 2 road actually requires.
But did the trial court, I mean, obviously given the trial court's ruling, the trial court didn't get in any of that, right?
It did not, because it really wasn't confronted with evidence to make a competent ruling. It probably wouldn't have gone there anyways, but it was their burden to establish.
But the trial court's point was, I don't need to hear all that. I have a legal answer that resolves this case, right?
Yes, but the trial court...
So right result, wrong reason doesn't generally apply when the right reason is essentially a fact-finding exercise.
They didn't put on the evidence, though, and there was, therefore, there's no evidence in the record, you know, and there was no, the judge didn't cut them off. The judge didn't say, I've made my ruling, you don't need to call an expert because I've made my ruling. That didn't happen. They just didn't put people in front of the judge or evidence in front of the judge to make it easy on the judge to say, oh, yeah, you're right, that's a clear violation of this requirement which applies here, and because I've connected the flow chart and agree with you. So I think they have a big evidentiary issue in addition to a legal one. Just paging through my notes with the remaining time here, you know, we obviously rest in our brief with respect to the other issues. So, you know, I think that the court has three options. Affirm the trial court's decision. We can live with that. even though it did find that there was a violation. Option two is uphold the trial court's decision in part, but find that the road maintenance agreement did meet the HOA requirement, or grant our motion to strike and find that they just didn't put on a case. As Judge Parker said, he was expecting a lot more evidence and testimony. So,
thank you. Your time has expired. The court will take a recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.